any money to reach a pit, or rather to review a couple of remarks from the previous week, and that is to get a picture of the conditions in the United States with the ending of the war. We pointed out how the end of the war produced a terrific strike wave in the United States, culminating in a period in which 2 million workers were on strike at one time. The automobile workers of General Motors, a general strike by the steel workers, a strike by the United Electrical, and so forth, which gives us an idea of the pent-up anger of the working class as a result of the restrictions on their wages during the war period. This was a period in which the Socialist Workers' Party was on the march, and in the period of since the end of the war up to 1946 convention had recruited about 500 workers, because there was no other place for the workers to turn to outside the Socialist Workers' Party. They couldn't join the scabby Communist Party, and the only one left was the Socialist Workers' Party, a party which they respected because they saw that during the war, the membership of the Socialist Workers' Party didn't retreat, didn't support the American imperialists, but instead supported its own interest, which was the working class. And we reported how the 1946 convention of the Socialist Workers' Party was a convention of that was bubbling over with the optimism of the coming American Revolution, of building the party that was going to take the leadership in the coming American Revolution that would come as a result of the breakdown of capitalism once production had caught up with the needs around 1948-49, we figured. And at this convention, the American Party adopted a thesis on the coming American Revolution. That is, this thesis analyzed the state of American economy side by side with the world economy, analyzed the changes in the political setup of the world since the Russian Revolution, the results of the Second World War, and foretold the coming explosions throughout the various sections of the world against world imperialism, and culminating in the revolution in the United States, pointing out that once production had caught up to consumption as a result of the war, would come a collapse of American imperialism because of the lack of markets, and that this would result in a tremendous radicalization of the American working class. And this working class, having learned the lessons of the Depression of 1930, having seen the discreditment of the American Communist Party, would turn to the Socialist Workers' Party for leadership, and it would culminate in the coming American Revolution. This is known as the American thesis in the lingo of the Socialist Workers' Party. And there is a copy of that resolution and thesis, and the comrades should read this. They're on sale here. They should read this thesis if they wish to understand what is the particular role and why has the Socialist Workers' Party got the optimism that carried it through the terrible period of reaction of the last 10 or 15 years. I reported how the convention of 1946 closed under the slogan put forward by Comrade Dobbs, forward to a party of 10,000 in 1948, to a mass party of action, no longer propaganda, but a party of action and agitation. Now, unfortunately, the thesis of the American Party was not fulfilled in the next few years. There was no collapse of American capitalism or American imperialism, and the thesis was pushed in the background. And we have to understand why that was pushed in the background. It was pushed in the background because the slight collapse that started to develop in American capitalism in 1947-48 was removed by the development of the Cold War, was removed by the development of international events. Now, if you read the Militant, the bound volumes of the Militant, published during the war years, 1940, 41, 42, 43, 44, you will see repeated articles. Or if you read the magazine of the Socialist Workers' Party in that period, you will see repeated articles in which the American foreign policy is exposed as one that is preparing for a war against the Soviet Union after the ending of the Second Imperialist War. The Soviet Union is the ally of the American imperialists in this Second World War, but at the same time, the American capitalists are laying the groundwork of encirclement of the Soviet Union, ready to tackle it after the end of the Second World War. Not the next day, not the next year, but when the time was opportune. And this whole plan was upset by the revolt of the soldiers all over the world, the American soldiers all over the world, who in great mass demonstrations demanded that they be demobilized and taken home, or taken home and demobilized. This upset the whole war schedule of American imperialism. But with the opening of the Cold War, which was caused by the Stalinists being forced to nationalize the property, or to socialize the property in the eastern countries of Europe, as a defensive measure against American imperialism, after Churchill had issued his famous war cry at Fulton, Missouri, to fight against the barbarism of communism and so forth and so on, this Cold War declaration was accompanied by various acts of American imperialism. One was the program of rearming the country, rearming the armed forces, rebuilding the armed forces, and side by side with that, of rearming their allies throughout the world. Not their allies, but their satellites throughout the world. And the rearming of their satellites plus the rebuilding of another army brought prosperity that we call prosperity today. That is, it brought full employment. And from 1947 up to this very day, there has been full employment in the United States due to the war machine. Now, side by side with this Cold War declaration and the acts of rearming, of rebuilding an army, and of also rearming their satellites throughout the world, the American imperialists figured that they had enough of the nonsense of the Communist Party, plus the fact that they also had to continue to tame the American labor movement. And they did this in various ways. They opened up on the Communist Party through their trade union agents. That is Walter Reuther, a man of very high moral standing, James Carey, and noble creatures like Dan Tobin, and other gangsters, trade union gangsters, that's about the only way you can describe them, trade union leaders who used the trade union movement to feather their own nest, some of them multimillionaires, like Hutchinson of the Carpenters Union and so forth. Well, the government gave orders to their agents to open up on the Communist Party, and in collaboration with the Justice Department, in collaboration with the political department of the government, that is the Senate and the Congress, who aided the trade union fakers in driving the communists and the radicals out of the trade union movement. Murray, head of the CIO, undertook the driving of the communist leadership out of the trade union movement. The other trade union leaders, aided and abetted by the Justice Department and by McCarthy, drove the rank and file trade unionists, radical trade union workers, out of all the unions in the country. I explained last week how this was done. They would have hearings in the various cities of the country, and summon dozens of workers from one plant after another, from these big corporations, like in the United States, in Lynn here. They had a hearing about the Reds in the General Electric plant down in Lynn. And they just summoned the workers one after the other, put them through the grinder. And the only way that these inquisitions could be answered was by giving your name and address, and that was all. Nothing else. You couldn't answer any other question without involving yourself into becoming a stool pigeon or in contempt of the hearing itself. I might say while we're talking about this that Mike's father, Don Comey, an organizer of the Electrical Workers Union, gave a real demonstration of the enraged worker before these super demagogues and bribe takers, as all politicians are. When he had his hearing down in Washington, he told the committee where they could go. And in old polite language, that's why he's not invited into the better parlors. Now the Cold War and this oppression by the government, utilizing the Justice Department, the Legislative Department, the trade union fakers that control the movement, drove the working class radical movement into the corner. The Communist Party was decimated, and the Socialist Workers' Party was also decimated on the trade union front. All radical workers were hounded out of their respective unions unless they belonged to a really democratic union like the Typographical Union, of which I'm a member. Thousands and thousands of working class people lost their jobs in the plants. Men and women that had 2 and 3 and 4 decades of seniority was wiped out overnight because they were, in one way or another, had the label of communists put on them by this witch hunt. Of course, the Communist Party was infested with rats and agents of the FBI. Alongside of that, the intellectuals of all the segments of American society that at one time or another took up the cudgels of the international working class and for the defense of the Soviet Union, the intellectuals were the ones that played the most miserable role during this period of Inquisition. They were the ones that inevitably collapsed in order to save their position in society, to remain a professor of nonsense at such and such a college. They confessed. They opened up their hearts, their bosoms, and they repented and recovered their patriotism. We could go into a long list of them, one after the other. But we're very proud to say that as far as we know, there was only one Trotskyist that capitulated to the wave of patriotism, and that was Harold Isaacs, who is now a teacher or professor or a would-be professor or some kind of a yakker over at MIT, teaching in the humanities. That's a pretty stuff, the humanities. Not sociology, or some phase of sociology, but the humanities. Imagine a stool pigeon teaching humanities. Here's a man, he's teaching the truth to the young students, to young men and girls over at MIT, teaching them the values of what the bourgeois call, well, of course, what the hell would you expect from a bourgeois values? Bourgeois values are get ahead, period. And that's written in big, bold-faced letters, black. Get ahead. That's what you're born for, to get ahead. Well, that's what Isaac is teaching over at MIT. This man wrote a book. He was in China during shortly after the terrible catastrophe of the 20s, and he wrote a book called The Tragedy of the Chinese Revolution. The foreword was written by Leon Trotsky. And this man paints a picture of the cause of the terrible debacle in 1925-27. Well, when the war broke out, he was still a Trotskyist. He scribbled for the militant. And then he capitulated later on. I heard that, I think it was he that Jim referred to in a joking way, Jim Cannon. He said, can you imagine a guy saying I have to quit the party because my wife is going to have a baby? This guy, son of wealthy parents. But his wife is going to have a baby, so he has to quit the party. Well, now if he's going to be a good learned professor and hold his job at MIT and suit his ego by being a professor, an educator, he has to disown this book. So what he did was he sat down and he rewrote the book in the opposite sense of which he'd written the first edition. Now there's a nice peddler of truth and honesty and decency. Well, MIT can keep him. The Socialist Workers' Party doesn't want him. One of the most notorious raps contributed by the intellectual world to the communist cause in those days was a man named Wexler, the peddler of truth and honesty and everything that's decent and holy and sacred to our hearts. The editor of the New York Post, he ratted, but he couldn't do it in the public. He requested a secret hearing from Mr. McCarthy, and he had a secret hearing. You know what comes out in secret hearings. This is the same man that every once in a while will break in through the print with a denunciation of the Reds, even to this day. What imagine the contempt we can have for these kinds of people. Now this hounding of prosperity had an effect on the Socialist Workers Party, too. This wave of prosperity and the development of the Cold War and the hounding of the Reds had an effect on the Socialist Workers Party, too. The skilled workers, living in a dream world of a full paycheck, month after month, year after year, overtime and so forth and so on, are being affected by this wave of prosperity. They're being affected by the terrible propaganda that is now whipped up by the American press, yelling at the top of its lungs for a holy crusade and a holy war against communism. Communism is spreading all over the world. It took over Eastern Europe. And lo and behold, in China, the Chinese people took over their own government. After all, we went to war against Japan in 1941 because we were going to take over China, as our province. But the Chinese masters over double-crossed us decided that they'd like to run their own country. Well, this had a terrific effect on the American capitalist. You can easily understand. The capitalist is out to protect his or her property, and with the spreading of communism throughout the world, the communist movement marching from one victim to the other, seizing the property of the holy capitalist class in one country or another, made the capitalists rise to a frenzy. We might say that following the Chinese Revolution came the Korean War. We could go through the whole period and name one revolution after another that was put down in one way or another by American imperialism or one of its satellites. The Indonesian business of the French imperialists, the nationalization of the oil industry in Iran, which caused a counter-revolution financed by the British capitalists or acted through by the British capitalists, taking orders from their masters in Wall Street, and so on and so on. This, all of these different events, the spreading of the Socialist Revolution, the attempted takeover of the Guatemalan government, one of the banana republics of the United Fruit Company, which was only a liberal government, but the mere fact that they had a liberal government that promised land reform was enough to set the American capitalists in a frenzy, and they openly financed, no hidden facts, openly financed the counter-revolution in Guatemala. Well, this was a result of the frenzy that the American capitalists had gone into as a result of the seizure of their property in Eastern Europe, the Chinese Revolution, and the Korean War. And under this kind of a bombardment of propaganda, plus prosperity, there was a general collapse among the better sections of the working class, the skilled workers particularly, and that spread into the Socialist Workers Party. Now, no party, no Marxist party has ever been built in a period of prosperity. No party, no Marxist party. You read the history of Marxism, which is over 100 years old now, and you will not find one party was ever built in a period of prosperity. Marx and Engels, the great founders of Marxism, and don't think for one minute that they were just armchair theoreticians, that all Marx was interested in was rushing down to the London Museum. Don't think that that was all of Marx's interest in life. When the Paris Commune broke out, Marx and Engels were pulling at the leash to get into the argument one way or the other. When the German events developed, Marx and Engels were pulling at the leash to get into the events one way or the other. They were activists. They were organizers. They weren't armchair theoreticians. They were men of action. And yet, despite their great knowledge and their activity, they couldn't build a revolutionary movement in England, which was their adopted country. They couldn't build a revolutionary movement in any country of Europe. Why? Because after 1848, European capitalism leaped forward with 10-league boots. And the great wave of prosperity engulfed Western Europe. The standard of living rose year by year. The workers forgot all about 1848, forgot all about the lessons of teachings of Marxism that they learned through the First International. The German socialist movement, founded in this period of prosperity, degenerated overnight. The German social democracy. There has never been a Marxist movement built in a period of prosperity. We see an example of what happened to the American Communist Party in the 20s. Built, founded by men and women that were absolutely dedicated their whole life to the building of a communist movement to do away with American imperialism. But they were overcome by American prosperity. Now, just as the war, the threat of war, and the breaking out of war causes a collapse inside the revolutionary movement, so also a tremendous wave of prosperity also causes a collapse inside the revolutionary movement. But it affects two different classes in two different ways. In two different classes in one way, that is, get the hell out of the movement. When the war breaks out, the petty bourgeois, as a rule, run and dash away from the revolutionary movement. They're under the pressure of their bourgeois friends and their petty bourgeois friends. The workers, as a rule, run away from the movement in a period of prosperity. And the SWP, being a party that's living in living life, and not living in the dark rooms of Daniel De Leon, like the Socialist Labor Party does, is subject to all these pressures. We were subject to it in 1940, when the petty bourgeois revolted, and we were subject to it during this period of prosperity, when a section of the working class in our party revolted. And the revolt was reflected in our party, mainly among the automobile workers in Detroit and in Flint, Michigan. Now, there was a book published about the Cuban Revolution by a man named Miller. I think that was his name. 80 miles from home or 90 miles from home. And this book describes different scenes and interviews of this man who was very sympathetic to the Cuban Revolution, had while he went in Cuba a couple of years after the seizure of power by Del Castro and his comrades. And he tells about being in a restaurant one day when there's an argument among some people talking about Castro and his comrades. And one of them says, "Well, you know, the Castro that came down from the mountain wasn't the same kind of a Castro that went up the mountain." Hey, that's right. The Castro that went up the mountain went up in the days. He was for revolution. He wanted to get rid of Batista and his gang of cutthroats and hirelings of American capitalism. But the Castro that came down from the mountain was already on the march of socialism. See what I mean? He was not the same kind of a Castro. He had learned something up in the mountains. That the only way we can better the Cuban working class is to take the blessed property of the beloved capitalists and turn it over to the working class. Seize their nice, expensive apartment houses. And let the working people live in there for a change instead of being the janitors. Cut the rent of the bloodsuckers. Cut it 50%, cut it down 70%. Things like that. So it was a different man that went up to that came down from the mountain. The automobile workers and the Socialist Workers Party that went into the auto plants in the 30s or went into the auto plants 1939 and 40 when the war machine was gathering its strength. had now, by 1950, become skilled workers. They weren't at the bottom of the seniority list either. They had now accumulated 10, 15 years seniority. The first ones that were getting bounced were not them. There was a whole gang behind them. They had to fire these people first before they touched me. I'm not making $1.50 an hour, I'm making $3 an hour. I'm a different kind of an animal than I was 10 years ago. So, the Socialist Workers Party worker that went into the plant in 1939 was not the same kind of an animal that was in the plant in 1952. As Marx and Engels taught us through historical materialism, we're victims of our environment. My environment now is a $3 an hour boy. And I'm working with $3 an hour boys alongside of me. I'm no longer working with unskilled Afro-Americans that are always beeping about the brutality of capitalism. I'm no longer working alongside of the foreign worker making $1.50. In other words, my associations in life have changed. I'm a respectable, middle class, on the verge of the middle class, skilled worker. And that's what happened in the Socialist Workers Party. In other words, they had a stake in their job. Anybody that has seniority in a plant has a certain sense of security. There's a positive side, it's a contradiction from a revolutionary point of view, seniority. Because seniority tends to create a conservative element in the union. At the same time, it's a necessity. Because the boss can fire a radical worker overnight if he hasn't got seniority. Well, these elements in the plants, these Socialist Workers' Party members, developed a feeling of security. They want peace. Peace at any price. They were buying nice houses in Detroit. I remember in the 40s, one day down at the National, at the camp in New Jersey, talking with Jim. We were out on the platform there. And cars came in, three or four of them, one after the other. And Jim said, who drives those cars? And somebody said, the comrades are from Detroit. And Jim turned to me and said something about they living off the fat of the land. Too much. He was right. Jim foresaw. In 1940, in the early 40s, the middle 40s, who was running around with new cars? And this Detroit group, all of them were running around with new cars. They wanted peace. They were no longer uncomfortable. They were no longer the dregs of society on the edge of unemployment and so forth and so on. They were looking for peace, and they were looking for someone that would lead them out of the fields of darkness, lead them out of the Socialist Workers' Party into the land of the golden calf. And Cochran was their man. Now, Cochran was a leading member of the Socialist Workers' Party who was the leading element in the Socialist Workers' Party in the automobile setup and was looked upon as the leader of the automobile workers in the Socialist Workers' Party. And Cochran started to go through a change in the late 40s with the culmination of the big strike wave of 1946, then the great wave of prosperity opening up. Cochran started to develop a pessimistic outlook for the future. He started to develop concepts that the party was not going to lead the socialist revolution in this country. The revolution in this country, in all probability, may be led by the trade union leaders. He didn't picture John L. Lewis in that thing, but a revolution inside the trade union movement would throw a revolutionary leadership in the trade on the top of the trade unions and lead this trade union movement into a labor party set up that eventually would be pushed into a socialist revolutionary position. Well, he never expressed this concretely. Cochran was a very cagey guy. He was dishonest, period. That was Cochran. Cochrane never put down on paper his political concepts in this, of this period. He was a very talented guy, a very good speaker, a very good writer, and so forth. I didn't think much of his trade unionist. But he was a tin god in those days, in the automobile setup, full of pretensions. Now, side by side with this feeling that he had that the party was superfluous, also developed a contempt for the actions of the convention of 1946, in which the Socialist Workers' Party adopted the so-called American theses that I pointed out, the coming American Revolution. And Cochrane ridiculed them. Not openly, not before the party, but to comrades in Detroit. He also agitated and propagandized underneath the board, this was, that the party should possibly remain as a propaganda group and serve as a propaganda group to educate workers for the future labor party that was going to be created by the trade union leadership and carried through the socialist revolution. But this was all underneath the board. There was never anything put down on print. In other words, Cochrane was soul sick. He was groping for some way to drop this nonsense of socialism and the Socialist Workers' Party and jump into the big swim with the trade union fakers. Now, when we say in our lingo, when we say somebody is soul sick, we mean that they've lost faith in the socialist revolution. They're looking for a new program, a new role to follow, a new organization to join, but different from the Socialist Workers' Party because they've lost faith in it. They're groping in other words. Well, Cochrane was soul sick. But alongside of his soul sickness was also a tremendous arrogance. And he was a specialist in arrogance from a long way back. Now, side by side with Cochraneism, we also had another little grouping in the party, and that was a grouping led by George Clark. George Clark was one of the founding members of our party, a very good comrade, a comrade that was well-liked, a well-mannered comrade, a worker, a man that had taken 1,000,001 assignments for the party. No assignment was too tough or too big for George. As I said, he was well-liked by everybody. Well, he went across the water and he met a man named Pablo, who was the secretary of the Fourth International, and he came under the influence of Pablo. This Pablo that was the secretary of the International was a master of writing a resolution that meant two things. That is, you could read it and you'd say, yeah, that is, that's right, the world is flat. Yeah, yeah. Somebody else would read it? Yeah, that's right, I agree with him, the world is round. Jesus Christ, how the hell can it be both things? He was a master of writing a sentence that could be interpreted both ways. And if you felt this way, you'd say, yeah, that's fine, I agree with him, that's fine. Well, he developed the concept that, everybody had the concept that the world war was going to break out somewhere in the early 50s because of the terrible agitation of the American imperialists, the injecting of themselves in the Korean War, the suppression of the Iranian nationalization of the oil wells, and so forth and so on. And Pablo developed the concept that the communist parties throughout the world, in all probability, would be forced to become revolutionary under the pressure of the masses. And that meant that the scattered forces of the Fourth International should enter the communist party wherever was possible. That the communist rank and filers were becoming radical, that they were being pushed to the left, And they were going to force the leadership of the Communist International to become revolutionary. That, in brief, in very few words, was the concept that was peddled by Pavlov. Underneath the board, he conducted a struggle in all the various sections of the Fourth International against any leadership that he thought wouldn't swallow this lie. And he started with the French section, wiped the leadership out by engineering a split, that's on for something today, but he engineered a split in France where the majority was expelled because they wouldn't accept his leadership. And in the end, George Clark came back from Europe, bubbling over with enthusiasm over the line enunciated by Pavlov. And he propagandized, well, in the political committee meetings of our party here in the United States, there was a continual hassle between the interpretation of the resolutions adopted by the Fourth International. As you know, we're not a member of this organization, but we have fraternal connections with it. And we work very close with the Fourth International and take part in international discussions and so forth and so on, but we can't take part in any voting because that's against the law and we are law-abiding. Now, in the interpretation of these resolutions, Clark would interpret it one way. As I said, these resolutions, Pablo was a master of writing on both sides, voting very obliquely that could be interpreted one way or the other. There would be the hassle between Clark's interpretation and the majority. And eventually developed in New York City a grouping that accepted the ideas of Pablo and of Clark. And that is that the main activity of the party, particularly in New York City, should be towards penetration of the Communist Party. And the penetration of the milieu of the Communist Party, because the ranks were becoming radicalized and we could recruit them into our party. The majority of the party said nothing doing. That's all nonsense. The rank and file of the Communist Party is used up. They're hopelessly demoralized by the actions of their leadership and so forth, by the betrayals and whatnot. And if you're going to build a revolutionary party, it has to be built outside the ranks of the Communist Party. Therefore, we shouldn't pay too much attention to the Communist Party any more than we pay to any other opponent organization. Well, this caused a turmoil inside the New York organization. Now, that meant that the party now was engaged in two struggles. It was engaged in a struggle against the pessimism put forth by Cochranism, by Cochran in Detroit and in Flint, but underneath the board, as I say, nothing was ever produced on paper. And at the same time, it's conducting a struggle against the Stalinist orientation enunciated by Pavlov and carried out by his agent George Clark in the United States. These two groupings united. Clark's group, the automobile workers in Detroit, and Cochran's gang in Detroit, the automobile workers, who were living off the fat of the land, and Clark's group in New York City. Now, what did the automobile workers think about this orientation towards Stalinism? I said that the Stalinists were the most despised and the most hated trade unionists in this country. Not only by Phil Murray and the gangsters that ran the trade union movement, but by the rank and file militants. The militants in the United States, unaffiliated, not political militants, but real trade union militants, hated and despised the Communist Party because of its role during the war, yelling for more production, yelling for incentive pay, peace work and so forth, yelling for the buying of bonds, yelling for speed up and so forth and so on, yelling for strike breaking actions, yelling for submission to the boss, whooping it up for the War Labor Board and so forth. So that when the ending of the war came, the Stalinists didn't have a friend. When Murray and his gang decided to throw the Stalinists out of the CIO, the militants cheered. They thought it was wonderful. Get rid of the rats. Get rid of the scabs, the strike breakers. The militants were happy. For anyone to associate with the Stalinists, and I might say that of all the unions in this country, the most militant, the most politicalized was the automobile union. That was the most political union in this country, the most advanced rank and file in this country. And they knew the Stalinists inside out. The average trade unionist might have hated the Stalinists for being scabs and strike breakers, but the automobile workers despised them because they were 10 times as more advanced than the average worker. Well, you can imagine how our comrades in Detroit felt about associating with the Stalinists. These gentlemen that now were skilled workers and was taking life in its stride felt embarrassed about being called a socialist, felt embarrassed about being associated with the Socialist Workers' Party. You can imagine how they felt if someone associated them with the Stalinists. In other words, Cochran and his gang had absolutely no use for the Stalinists. They hated them and despised them and didn't want them near them. They didn't want to be contaminated in any way at all with Stalinism. Well, they sat down and laid down in the same bed with Platt and the pro-Stalinist lineup that Clark had developed in New York City. What is that? What do you call that? What do we call Schachman's gang? What do we call Abrams' gang in lining up with Musty against entrance into the Socialist Party? An unprincipled combination. Unprincipled politics. What does it mean? It means death. It means death to the revolutionary politician. Well, they formed this bloc and came to a plenum of the National Committee in 1952 of May, where a general discussion was held on this position of the approach of the Communist Party in New York City and the advocacy that was carried throughout the country, of course, by Clark. And at the May plenum, a vicious fight took place, a vicious political fight, between the Cochran Clark group and the majority of the National Committee. It left nothing settled. Cochran, of course, submitted no documents about refuting the program of the Socialist Workers' Party, saying that it was a lot of nonsense and so forth and so on, which he actually believed. But instead of that, took up the cudgels and became the lawyer for George Clark and for Pavlov. The majority, led by Cannon, was anxious to avoid a split. Not that the majority for one minute thought it was possible to save Cochran. He was gone. But the hopes were that some of the rank and file members that were following Cochran through a period of prolonged discussion could be broken away from Cochran and saved, because some of them were very talented trade union workers. At this time, Pablo's role was unknown. Nobody knew for sure whether Pablo was the man behind Clark or whether these were some of Clark's aberrations, which George unfortunately was known for once in a while, going off on the deep end. But Pablo's role was not known. And the result was that the plenum ended in a compromise or in a deadlock. No actions were taken against the minority comrades. They were given the same post they had before the plenum. Clark was on the staff of the militant, and so forth. The political committee wasn't changed like it was changed in the struggle against Schachman. And while I'm on this subject, I might say that here is a lesson in democratic centralism. As we said before, democratic centralism is a contradiction in terminology. But we believe in democratic centralism as the organizational setup of our party. We make all our decisions by democratic discussion in the rank and file of our party. Then we take a vote and come to a decision, and the minority must obey that decision the same as the majority. In other words, we have centralized action in carrying out a decision, but arrive at that decision in a democratic fashion. Now the party leadership has a responsibility to the rank and file, and that is to carry out the program of the party. That's the responsibility of a majority of the National Committee. And when that majority is threatened by a revolt in the ranks of the party, it has to stabilize itself and make sure of carrying out the program of the party. Now in 1939, the political committee, which is the top committee of the party, which runs the party on a week-to-week basis, since members of the national committee are scattered all over the landscape, this subcommittee runs it, runs the party. Well, in 1939, this subcommittee happened to have six members that were Schaffnerites, and one member that was for standing pat on the party program. Obviously, something had to be done. How can people that are in revolt defend the party program? And that was settled at a plenum of the National Committee in September 1939. A new political committee was set up arbitrarily by the majority. The majority said, we have the task of defending the program of the party, and we intend to do it. And we intend to do it by changing the political committee composition. And we're going to set up a political committee made up of 9 members, 6 of the majority and 3 of the minority. And you can yell all you want about democracy and blah, 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 blah. Doesn't mean anything. That's Leninism. That's Leninism. Well, in this case, nothing had to be done because the majority of the political committee were defenders of the party. Now, as I said, we had no differences with Pavlov. We didn't know his role. The Socialist Workers' Party hadn't locked horns at all with this guy, with Pavlov. And the international leadership was, as far as we knew, loyal to the program of the international and loyal to the various sections of the international. But shortly after the plenum, we heard from Healy, the leader of the British Trotskyist movement, and he gave us the tip-off that Clark was really an agent for Pavlov. Just as Pavlov had established agents in various other countries throughout the world. And at Pavlov, he said that Pavlov was trying to create new leaderships in the various parties throughout the world. He wrote a document, I couldn't find it, I let somebody take it. Pavlov wrote a document in which he said that the old Trotskyists should retire to the hills. Here's a guy that never pushed an apple cart over. He's going to tell Cannon, scram bum, you don't know what's going on in the world. Well, he wasn't very popular after he wrote that document. And after we found out that Clark was really his agent. Now, after the plenum, reports were given to the various branches by National Committee members that were attendant at the plenum. And Clark, at this plenum, a general truce was declared. A truce of loyalty by the majority to the rights of the minority, and the majority said they respected the party program and the right of the majority to run the party and defend the program of the party. But hardly had this truce been signed when Clark made his reports in the New York membership meeting, which violated completely and overthrew the declaration of truce at the plenum. His main slogan was, junk the old Trotskyism. We're living in a world of new reality. The new reality is that the world revolution is going to break out tomorrow morning. The Stalinists are going to lead the revolution, but the workers are going to push them to the left, and Stalinism is going to reform itself. Now, this sounds like the ravings of a madman, but I assure you, I'm not mad. And if we're smart, since the Stalinists are going to take the leadership of the revolutionary movement and be pushed to the left and become revolutionary once more, it's the sensible thing to do for the Fourth Internationalists to shimmy up to the Stalinists and get close to their rank and file, and if necessary, join their party so as to carry on the revolutionary struggle inside the party. And Detroit also carried this kind of action out by, instead of maintaining the truce, they gave the same kind of a report to the rank and file members in Detroit. Well, by this time, the leadership of the Socialist Workers' Party recognized that we were in for a fight, and that this thing had to be settled one way or the other, and that there was no such a thing as compromise. And the boom was lowered on Cochran and on Clark. We also recognized that it was not a fight just to save the Socialist Workers' Party, but a fight to save the international from Pavlovism and from becoming a left political cover for world Stalinism. If you wish to read a full account of this, read the bound volume of the Militant, in which the declaration by the American Party against Pablloism was printed in a three-page spread. From now on, Clark and Cochran boycott all party activities. Finances are completely cut off from the Socialist Workers' Party. And all their activity and responsibilities now are not to the Socialist Workers' Party, but to their own caucus and their own faction ends. By this time, we were in touch with various other comrades throughout the world that gave us information on dealings that Pablo had with their party. A French comrade wrote and told us that Pablo will agree to any kind of a political resolution going. It makes no difference to him. All he's interested in is controlling the apparatus of the international. Shortly after this came the blow-up of the Berlin workers against the occupational forces and Stalinism. And during this period, Pablo, controlling the apparatus of the international, defended Stalinism against the Berlin workers. Almost side by side with the revolt in Berlin came the general strike in France. And the French Trotskyists, the ones that were expelled, the Orthodox French Trotskyists, the majority of the French Trotskyists, naturally supported the French workers in their general strike. And they were denounced by Pablo. Because Pablo was shimmying up to the Stalinists, who were scabs and strikebreakers in France the same as they are in this country. The climax came at the anniversary meeting of the Russian Revolution on November 7th, 1953, when the Cochran-Clark group boycotted the meeting to a man. Not one single one of them came to the anniversary meeting. Upon this action, the whistle was blown for a special meeting of the National Committee of the Party, and there was only one point on the agenda: give the boys the heave-ho. And we had I'll never forget it, we had our plenum. Didn't last very long. Who's in favor of throwing them out? And that was it. No arguments, no discussions, or any other thing. And they just got up and walked off. They knew they wanted to be thrown out. They wanted to be thrown out. They sighed a sigh of relief as they walked out the door. Now you can read a document written by Cochran. This was written by Cochran, no doubt about it. Although Frankel, who was another megalomaniac, probably wrote part of it. And if you wish to get a picture of their side of the story, all you have to do is read this document, The Roots of the Party Crisis. I won't go into it because I haven't got the time. But let me say that Schachman, if you read Schachman's document in the tail end of the Struggle for a Proletarian Party, there you'll find the weeping and the moaning of Schachman and Burnham protesting the brutality of canonism and how canon is really a dope and so forth and so on. Doesn't know his actions at all. He has to wait until Trotsky tells him to put out his right foot or put out his left foot and so on. And how he's an aspiring Stalin. Blah, 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 blah. And he surrounds himself with a pack of ignorant hand raisers. Well, that's what this document is, though. At least, as I told Gussie, we give Schachman credit. He didn't plagiarize somebody. But these people had to sit down and plagiarize everything that that Schachman wrote. The only trouble is that Schachman's story was a collection of half-truths. A collection of about incidents that the poor man didn't understand, whereas Cochran's document here is just outrageous lies and written for people that were hopelessly demoralized and that it was too kind of a talk to and hopefully in any way at all to save. Now, we've talked about these internal struggles, and I'll give you a little tip off on internal struggles. There is never a minority in our party. I don't know about other parties, but there's never a minority in our party. Well, if you read the correspondence of Marx and Engels, they will tell you also about internal struggles in parties. that they had to take action in. But there was never a struggle in our party where a minority didn't sing to the high heavens about being oppressed, that their democratic rights are being abused, that their members are being removed from top posts in the party, that this minority hasn't got all the bright ideas, and that the majority are just a pack of hopeless fools that don't know what to do. And this is almost without exception in every factional struggle that we've ever had. Shachtman's gang had all the bright ideas. This fool Cannon had to write to Trotsky all the time to find out what to do. In this document written by Cochran, Cannon didn't know what to do half the time. Even believe it or not, I'll read you something that it was absolutely hair-raising. You know how Cannon was the first one in 1939 to say that the Shachtman-Burnham group was subject to alien class pressures, to the pressures of the petty bourgeois, and that they were bringing these ideas into the Socialist Workers' Party. I don't think that Shachtman had a monopoly on this idea, because these boys who had no ideas, no original ideas, plagiarized them, Shachtman, and wrote this kind of nonsense. At that time, 1939, Burnham and Shachtman bitterly opposed the policy of Cochran, Dunn, and Clark in Detroit. No, that's not the one. Here we get the funny part. He's talking about a crisis that in the automobile situation that he concocted out of his own imagination. Because don't forget, there was a crisis in automobile that Jim Cannon writes about in the struggle for proletarian power. So Cochran, having a lot of originality, had to try to duplicate it. He's an original thinker, I guess. So here's what he says about alien class forces. But here they encountered the resistance when. See, Cochran saved the automobile situation for the Trotskyists in 1927. But here they encountered the resistance of a section of the leadership which had become a transmission belt for alien class forces in the party. Who were the alien class forces? Cannon, Ray Dunn, Farrell Dobb was in Detroit at that time, Hank Schultz. All trade union leaders in our movement. Every one of them a worker. But they try to make a story out of this. It's a good. It isn't worth much to read, Thomas, to tell the truth. You can learn more by reading Cannon's letters in regard to this period. They're published in mimeograph form, and I have some of them at the house, and some of the comics want to read about them. Who has Abrams' click now? Dave. Is Dave here? I thought Dave was here. Oh, he's gone. Oh, who has it? You threw it? Pass it on to somebody else. Let me know who has it, though, Dave. You know, keep trying. He's got a nice funny book, and we want to have that back for the revolution, so we can sit down and drink beer and read it. Now, another thing about interfactional struggle, as I said, don't forget, they all are oppressed. What Walforth was oppressed, he didn't have his full democratic rights. Pete Camillo told me one time at one of the conventions, prior to one of the conventions, Walforth had 14 internal bulletins. 14 internal bulletins. I couldn't believe it, but he said, yeah. I said, well, I don't read them, of course. I read the first couple, you know, get the line. The rest is just crap, bellyaching. Didn't he cry about the terrible oppression that he was under in the Socialist Workers' Party? He didn't have his full democratic rights. Shachtman and Burnham, their internal bulletins this high. They were stepped on, too. Cochran and Clark, their internal bulletins that high. They were stepped on, too. Clark was removed from his post on the militant. The same as Shachtman was removed from his post on the militant in 1939. Didn't they cry about that too? Didn't tell you that Shachtman ran off and deserted his post. They don't tell you that Clark was removed from being one of the editors of the militant alongside of Morris Stein, John G. Wright, and Joe Hansen. All this kind of trickery is what can ensnare a comrade that is new to the business. So don't get taken in with the story about being oppressed. Don't get taken in with these stories about how the majority are a pack of dopes and don't know what's going on in the world, and we save the situation time after time. Don't get taken in with the story about being removed from posts. And demand documents. Go by the documents in an internal struggle. Not by what you hear, not by what is said, but what is said in black and white. That's the way Trotskyists carry on an internal struggle. You have disagreements? Look it. Put it down on paper. That's what we try to do with Cochran. That's what Cannon would try to do with Cochran. Cochran wouldn't put them down on paper. He wanted to connive underneath the board and in one way or another get thrown out of the party so that he could talk about how he was mercilessly oppressed and was forced out of the movement.